Hello and welcome back to History by Hollywood. This is episode 65, Monster Part 2. We're just going to play the clip we went out with at the end of last week again to set the scene, and then we'll continue with the conclusion of 2003's Monster.
Just a small town girl, living in a lonely world. She took the midnight train going anywhere.
I must have been around 13 years old because I remember I just put the baby up for adoption. They called an assembly at my junior high because this guy who played drums for Slim Whitman was coming to talk to us about success and making your mark on the world.
I don't have any experience per se, but I'm a real hard worker.
I was real excited because he was the first real celebrity I'd seen, and this was exactly the kind of thing I wanted to learn how to follow in the footsteps of.
I don't even write it down, you know, it just stays right there. And you should know that I've worked with people all my life. So I'm real good with people, and I know how to work a Rolodex.
So I listened real hard to any advice he had. And for sure, he said something that just stuck right in my mind. It was, all you need in life is love and to believe in yourself. And then there's nothing you can't do.
Right. You make sure that I have all of this straight. Basically, you have no experience, no college degree, no resume, no work history whatsoever, in fact, and now you would like to be a lawyer, right?
No, see, I was, I'm sorry, but when I read the ad, it said that you were looking for a secretary.
Okay. Well, you need to learn how to type. You'll need computer skills. Most of our secretaries have college degrees. In fact, most of them have specialized in law. I don't mean to sound harsh, but frankly, it's a little insulting. I see you're from Daytona Beach, and all of that looks great. It must be wonderful, but can I tell you something? When the beach party is over, you don't get to say, you know what? I think now I'd like to have what everybody else has worked their entire life for. It doesn't work that way.
F*** you, man. Yeah, f*** you. You don't f***ing know me.
Okay, great. That's great. See, now I'm so sorry I didn't hire you before. Leslie, could you please escort Miss... I don't even know her name because, of course, she doesn't have a resume out.
You don't need a escort, you piece of shit. What, you think I'm a retard? Take your f***ing job and f***ing shove it.
So, after Eileen has her hopes dashed of getting what you might call a proper job, the girls are in a biker's bar where she's known, and the barman says she can't have any more tab. So she laughs about it before asking Selby if she can't call her dad. Presumably to ask him for money. Selby's expression tells her the answer. Next, we see Eileen in a labour exchange, but we learn that she's got a felony conviction, so would only get factory work, and that's not very well paid, and there isn't that much of it either. Again, Eileen loses her temper, and the lady in the labour exchange kind of just turns her back on her and walks off. Walking along the street, looking pretty despondent, Eileen is pulled by a cop who says, "You're going to have to come with me because we've had some complaints." When he gets her in the car, he reveals he knows her as a hooker and he totally lacks sympathy with her trying to go straight and all this. He pulls into a car park, reminds Eileen that he busted her some months before, but he said, "I went easy on you, so you owe me one." And he's clearly angling for some sexual favours. Next, we see Eileen walking away again, and she sees a newspaper in a trash can with a headline saying that the police have no leads on the murder of a 51-year-old man. She smiles and heads back to Selby to find the girl in tears, terrified that they have no prospects now that she's quit hooking. And they argue, and then Eileen reveals, "Look, I killed the last John. She said I was being raped and beaten, but I did kill him." She expects Selby to be horrified and shouts at Selby to, you know, leave me, I'm too dangerous to be around kind of thing. But Selby instead hugs her, telling Eileen that she's sorry.
Yeah, well, we have no way to verify the scene about the policeman being taking sexual favours, taking advantage of the hooker, do we?
I can't imagine it's never happened.
Yeah.
Whether it actually happened, you know, around that period of her life to Eileen, I don't know, but I guess they were probably used to being busted now and again.
does show, though, that she, the world is rejecting her in every possible way, dehumanising her in every possible way, and just when she thinks that she's hit rock bottom and that she's going to even lose Selby and push Selby away, that the world kind of turns a little bit for her and Selby wants to stay with her and, you know, looks like she's got a loyal friend now when she just a moment ago felt like she had nothing.
Yeah, I mean, certainly one interview I've seen with her, I think it was Nick Broomfield's first documentary, which was done in the early night, made in the early 90s. I think it was Selling, is it The Selling of a Serial Killer, I think. But he asked her, and she said, yeah, I kept trying to get regular jobs, but she said, I couldn't get a start. She just couldn't get that first break to get a job, to generate some experience and get a reference to then get a better job. She could never get on that first rung of the ladder. And, you know, you can understand that that's probably true. And she certainly was given no breaks or advantages in life. Whether that's an excuse for what, well, it clearly isn't an excuse for what she went on to do. And again, we come back to this thing about the bar. This is the bar that's called The Last Resort, the biker bar we see her in. And it is the actual bar frequented by the real Eileen Wuornos. And the landlord said, whenever Charlize Theron was in there during the making of the film, she was in character. And he said, it was so eerie. He said, it freaked some of the guys out because who'd known Eileen, they were like, she's just come back to life. Because she obviously, by the time the movie was made, she had been executed. Sorry, spoiler alert. Yeah, he said she had her mannerisms and movements absolutely down pat, which must be a bit creepy.
Yeah, but and quite the achievement, given that they couldn't have met.
No, definitely. No, I think she did. There's a lot of film of her, so yeah. I guess Charlize Theron just studied that and spoke to people who'd known her. Yeah, okay. Would you like to take us back to the movie, yeah?
Okay, we see Eileen, she's returned to the streets. And we see her again being picked up by a man in a car who wants her to call him Daddy as they have sex. As the man gets himself ready, Eileen looks tense and then suddenly shoots him. He falls out of the car door as she finishes him off with another shot. Then we see her driving off in his car before rejoining Selby and throwing a wad of banknotes at her. She doesn't tell Selby where she got the money or the car, but Selby is clearly curious. Eileen tells her that she borrowed the car from a friend. Then in quite a tender scene, Eileen emerges from the shower. She and Selby share a few words before Eileen tells her that she loves her. Their friendship and relationship is finally consummated. We see the girls go out driving and see them moving in an apartment or maybe a small house. Eileen takes Selby out for dinner and tells her that they're going to go to the Keys, Florida Keys I assume, and then buy a house on the beach somewhere. Selby lights a cigarette, but they're told to put it out by the restaurant manager. Eileen again becomes instantly aggressive. We see her practicing her gun draw before she's with another punter in the car, parked in the dark.
Sorry, yeah, that's not the same scene, but Eileen gets very aggressive with the restaurant manager.
She does.
In, threatens. And then we cut to her in the, I think she's in the bathroom, and she's practicing her gun draw back at their apartment.
Yeah, so she's gone all aggressive completely. And we see her then with another client in his car, parked in Dark Woods. Eileen is now the aggressor, telling this big guy that he probably likes it rough and wants to slap Eileen around. She's clearly trying to work herself up so she can justify to herself what she's planning to do with him. So we've got a clip of that scene.
I bet you're getting real rough back there, huh? Real nasty. You like that, huh? You gonna slap me around a little bit, huh? Don't think I don't see it, man. What, you can't speak? What the f***? What, you got a f- problem? What, cat got your f- tongue, huh?
I don't like it rough. I've never done this before, but I have...
Take your pants off.
Yeah, so this guy is obviously very shy, very nervous, and I think this humanises Eileen to say, you know, she's not just going out and killing people, and people will hear her describe it later. She says, I wasn't a thrill kill serial killer. I was just in it for the robbery. But with this guy, she obviously feels sorry for him. So she takes care of him using her hand. And then he says, he murmurs a thank you, and she growls, "You're welcome," But she doesn't kill him.
Yeah, you're right. Definitely dehumanise her. And it does do that a bit, doesn't it?
Yeah, no, it does. It's like, okay, she's got some empathy. She's not a psychopath. Just go to wrap that bit up in reality. The personal scenes between Eileen and Selby / Tyria are impossible to judge as far as accuracy goes, and we don't really know about the fat guy who we've just heard the clip with. We don't know if that specifically happened, but she definitely went with some men and didn't kill them.
Yes.
So that would suggest either they behaved in a certain way that triggered her, or she looked at them and thought, okay, they've got some money, they seem a likely guy. And she may well have had some kind of self-justification process of maybe if they swear or if they're rude to her. But she did go on, and she was convicted of killing another 5 men after Richard Mallory, but she confessed to a 7th, so 6 in total, but she confessed to a 7th, but his body was never found, so she was only charged and convicted for the 6th. Which we will now sort of see a series of scenes. This is Eileen gets in a pickup truck, and when we see Selby sleeping, and you sort of hear a distant shot. I don't think they're trying to suggest that Eileen shot this guy within gunshot sound range of where Selby was sleeping, but I think it's a device. Selby gets up and sees a drunk Eileen cutting out newspaper clippings about her crimes. Selby doesn't really examine or question her too much. He goes back to bed, but the next day he wakes a hungover Eileen and says, "I'm bored, I want to go out." She's a bit petulant teenager in this scene, isn't she? Eileen clearly isn't up to it, so Selby goes out alone, and she goes into a bar and is suddenly confident, telling stories about her exploits, and we realise that what she's telling this group of girls she's chatting to are stories she's actually heard from Eileen about Eileen's life. And it's a little bit cringe-making, isn't it, with the way she's going, "Yeah, then I slapped this guy down." It's this teenage-looking small girl.
Yeah, she's very insecure, and played pretty well by Christina Ricci, if that's the effect that they were trying to go for. She's fascinated by Eileen and, you know, wants to be her to some degree.
Yeah, no, definitely.
We see Eileen is cleaning the house and is furious that Selby's gone off, took the car and had a good time. Selby is still unaware that the car belonged to a man who is now dead. She tells Eileen that she wants to go out and meet people without Eileen scaring them all away. They do go out to a fun fair, and Eileen has gotten over her temper. But she sees Selby go off with her young friends that she'd made that afternoon. Eileen tries not to be hurt, as a voiceover tells us that her one talent is that she can learn. Selby is eventually left by her new friends, so she and Eileen ride the Ferris wheel. The next day, we see Selby is driving as Eileen tells her about her childhood and how she got into prostitution. A distracted Selby promptly crashes the car and the girls run off. Eileen tells her that the car belonged to a dead man. When they get back, Selby is terrified that they're coming for us, but Eileen assures her that they're not coming for them after all. She tells Selby to trust her, that she has collected clippings and the cops have nothing on them. Eileen then tells Selby that she knew all along, but Selby protests that she only knew about one, that first one that Eileen had confessed to. They sit down with a drink as Eileen explains to Selby that the world isn't as good as she thinks. Eileen wanted to protect her from the truth of how brutal the world really is, but she needs to know the truth. Selby says that she's wrong and she can't go around killing people. Eileen says that Selby's wrong. People kill people every day for politics, religion, profit. It's just how it is. Eileen assures Selby that the men she killed were all bad, or so she wouldn't have been able to have done it. She has a decent wedge of money on her and says that they just need a little more and they can have a shot at a real life. Selby then meets Donna, the friend of her parents that she stayed with, and explains to her that she has taken a decision to lead her life with Eileen, closing the door on her old life once and for all. Now, they really did crash your car, didn't they? That car crash scene is fairly accurate.
Yes, they crashed a car that had belonged to a missionary called Peter Seams. He's the 7th man who went missing, believed killed by Eileen, who confessed to his murder, but she was never charged because they never found his body. But it was from finger and palm prints left on this car that the police were able to track down Eileen and the real Tyria Moore.
That later on, that car crash is seen as instrumental in, you know, getting some sort of an identikit picture out there for both Eileen and Selby. And so that, even though they've brought it forward a little bit in the narrative, that's reasonably accurate evidence from the crash helped bring them down.
Yeah, definitely. Going back to the justification or not, Eileen said in interviews initially she only killed the ones she didn't like who were nasty to her. But then later, she'd had a temporary stay of execution put on her after her conviction. She was on death row for, I think, nearly 10 years. In fact, over 10 years, I think. But she when she was trying to have her execution upheld and actually go through with it, she said, "No, none of them are aggressive or violent. I just killed them ice cold." So, you know, you really don't. She changed her story so many times. It's very difficult to assess her state of mind at various stages of her life. So we don't really know any of the details.
We might get to this, but didn't she at one stage convert to Christianity so that she wanted to confess it all?
Yes, she did.
And so her motivations changed. It's really will be very hard to know when she was saying what.
There is one thing that's quite revealing when I think she was being interviewed about the killing of Richard Mallory, and a pathologist said she'd said that he was attacking her. This was in court, where she'd never said anything to the police before, but in court she said, no, he was trying to rape me, and he was violent, and she shot him in self-defense. But a pathologist said, or a forensic specialist said, no, the first bullet that hit him went through the back of his sleeve, and he said no, that he'd have been turned away from her when that happened. And when she was challenged about this, she kind of rolled her eyes and said, oh, I thought his body would be far too decomposed for you to be able to tell that kind of detail. Almost as if, oh well, it's worth a try.
Jeez.
So yeah, it's very difficult to tell exactly what happened.
Okay. Back to the movie. Yeah, we see Eileen walking into the woods with a man who seems confused as what they're doing out there. Why didn't they just stay in his car? Eileen says it's not great to be in a car when a gun is in there. The man looks nervous as Eileen tells him that she doesn't do what he thinks she does. Well, not anymore. The man starts to get dressed and tells her that he feels sorry for her, and if she wants a ride, she'd better come with him. Eileen pulls out her own gun and shoots the man down. In the car, she flips through his wallet and is horrified to learn that he's a policeman. She's really nervous when she gets back to Selby and says they have to catch a bus, so she couldn't take his car, him being a cop. Selby turns all cold-blooded and tells her that she needs to get him another car. It was Eileen's plan, and she needs to make sure that it happens. Then we see Eileen meet with Tom, Bruce Dern's character, the old fellow who she owed rent for the garage lockup. She says that she's come to say goodbye. He sympathises with her, and she walks home as Selby is watching a news report about a potential female serial killer, much to her horror. We see an old lady identifying a photo fit image of Eileen, the lady that witnessed the car crash when Selby lost control and crashed the car outside their house.
Just to interject with the little reality on that, I've not found any accounts that say she had any kind of encounter with an off-duty cop. So the bit of shooting a cop seems to be a movie device to increase the pressure on the girls and maybe suggest why the police suddenly got hot on their tail. Whereas in reality, it's because they got a fingerprint and a palm print from the crashed car.
Okay. It's a misty night back in the movie, and Eileen gets into an older man's car. She tells him that she's just trying to make some extra money, so maybe she can help him if he can help her. He comes across as a decent guy who offers her a room, saying he's sure his wife won't mind. She tells him to stop the car, clearly unable to bring herself to kill a potential Good Samaritan. She goes to get out, but her gun slips onto the seat. He gently asks her if she's in some sort of trouble. She points the gun at him and asks him to drive. After a while, she tells him to pull over and gets him to turn away from her and kneel. He's begging with her not to let him do this, but Eileen is distraught. She wails that she can't let him live. He tells her that his daughter is about to have a baby, but as Eileen howls, she pulls the trigger and obviously kills him. Now, it's worth pausing on that. We've already mentioned the missionary. This is probably a reference to him, yeah?
Yeah, the one closest to that are Peter Seams, and there are absolutely no suggestions whatsoever that he picked her up as a prostitute. And apparently this was one of her and many other girls' routines. They'd hitchhike, appear to be a hitchhiker. They'd show pictures of kids saying, look, I'm just trying to get down to see my kids. They've been taken into care, you know. But if you can help me out at all, maybe I can help you. So these are not curb crawling, sleazy men out looking for, you know, every night at the same place, regular prostitutes in the red light district. There's an element of just sort of, oh, okay, well, I didn't think of that, but if you want some money and you're going to offer something. But this guy is like, no, I'll help you, but I don't need anything from you. And then it's just because she drops the gun. And again, I've not found anything that says these are the circumstances in which her encounter with Richard Seems happened. Peter Seems happened. But it's a heart-rending scene.
Yeah, it's really effective.
You can see
really effective.
Her character, Eileen, does not want to do it. And this guy, he's begging for his life, but not. He's very calm. And he's just saying, you really don't have to do this. And she's like, I can't leave a witness.
Yeah. Yeah, dreadful stuff.
But any sympathy that the audience have for her, I think this is where it washes away. And you say, no.
Yeah, she got a bit of sympathy for us with the last guy that she took sympathy on, but I don't know, she's more desperate now, they're trying to portray, and she's got to just try and survive now and kill any witnesses. Okay, yeah. So back to the movie, we see, we're back now with Selby, and Eileen learns that there are some photo fits of them on the news. Eileen has bought Selby a bus ticket, and in tears, Eileen asks Selby if she can forgive her, as she's not sure she can forgive herself. They hug, both crying, as Eileen walks her to a bus and gives her all the remaining cash. Slumped on a bridge parapet, Eileen throws her gun into the water. We see her drunk in a bar where she's found by her old friend Tom, and there are some bikers hovering around as Tom tries to get Eileen to leave safely. Eileen's very drunk and asks the biker if he has any change so that she can call Selby. He says he does, but it's in his car. Let's go and get it. Staggering after him, suddenly she's grabbed by cops who cuff her, and we next see her in an orange prison suit. So the guys were trying to help her, I think, were undercover cops and just wanted to get her out of the bar so that they could arrest her en masse. We see Eileen speaking to Selby on a prison phone, telling her that they're going to be okay. Selby tells Eileen that her parents have been interviewed and that her photo is in the papers about the crashed car. Selby whines that she's going to get into real trouble over something that only Eileen did. Suspicious, Eileen asks her what she's doing, but Selby says she's not doing anything, just talking. Eileen asks her what happened to the money she gave her. Selby asks, what money? Which makes Eileen pause, then say it's nothing. The camera in Selby's room pans back, and we see that there's a whole bunch of cops sitting there recording her phone call, so she's obviously turned on Eileen. Eileen tells her that she'll never see her again, but the next scene we see Selby in court identifying Eileen, who has tears but nods with her acceptance. We don't hear a verdict being read out and a sentence being given. We do hear Eileen's response, telling the judge that she hopes he rots in hell, sending a woman to death as he's doing. Her voiceover says that love conquers all, and while there's life, there's hope. That's what they'll always tell you. So clearly, they're suggesting in this that Selby has turned to put all of the blame for everything onto Eileen, and Eileen understands this, and she agrees with it, and is taking the fall for everything that they've done. Yeah? That's what they're trying to get us to think.
Yeah.
Okay, so how do they go with that arrest scene? Is there any truth in that?
Yeah, but what's interesting, she was arrested on an outstanding warrant, but not for murder. Hence her apparent ease when she's first talking to Selby. She says something in the movie, she goes, they've picked me up on some, you know, it's a load of crap, it's this charge they've got, don't worry, you know, I'm talking to my lawyer and all that. But that's because they didn't want her to know that she was in the frame for murder. She got her talking to Selby, and it's very well done, this scene. You get this, she realises what's going on, and Selby's setting her up. And then she pauses and just accepts it and goes, okay, and sort of plays along. In reality, the police tracked Tyria Moore and arrested her and offered her a deal if she would help get them, help the cops gain evidence against Eileen, which she did. And in a phone call, she elicited a confession from Eileen. It's quite possible that Eileen knew this was happening. She seems to have held no grudge or resentment towards her former lover. And Tyrion Moore escaped with, I think, a minimal sentence, or maybe no sentence at all. Now, the movie's very last titles say that Eileen and Selby never met again, and Eileen was executed on October the 9th, 2002, after 12 years on Florida's death row. Initially, psychiatrists decided that Eileen was unfit to face execution, hence the amount of time she spent on death row, although that seems to be fairly normal. Then three psychiatrists independently agreed that she was fit to understand her crimes and the punishment decided by the state. And Governor Jeb Bush, brother of George W. Bush and son of course, the other President Bush, he lifted a temporary stay of execution, which, it must be added, was something that Eileen had asked him to do. She'd said, "I want the sentence carried out. I want the stay of execution removed so I can go ahead." There's an awful lot of debate about whether she was in her right mind when she wrote asking to be executed. Her last recorded words before her death by lethal injection were, "I'd just like to say I'm sailing with the rock and I'll be back like Independence Day with Jesus, June the 6th, like the movie Big Mothership and all, I'll be back."
Whoa.
So whether those are the words of a sane woman or not, I don't know. We mentioned earlier Nick Broomfield, who's made two documentaries about Eileen Wuornos. The first one, The Selling of a Serial Killer in 93, and Eileen, The Life and Death of a Serial Killer in 2003, both of which feature extensive interviews with Eileen herself. You can get them, the entire things, from various outlets, and they can be viewed on YouTube as well, and lots of clips. And it's worth just hunting down a few clips of Eileen. The spelling of her name's a bit strange. It's W-U-O-R-N-O-S. But Eileen, if you just put in Eileen Monster Movie, then you'll get all these clips of the real Eileen. You can see what an amazingly good job Charlize Theron did. And we've just got a clip here of the real Eileen speaking to Nick Broomfield and effectively confessing her crimes.
Nick, the reason I'm coming forth with you with this interview is because I like to come clean about my cases. And because there's only about 1% chance that a person can get off death row. So the chances of getting off death row are 1%, 99.9%, you're going to be on it and you're going to die. Okay, I cannot go in the execution chamber and die in the execution chamber as a liar. And I cannot go in the execution chamber and be executed under the devil. I have to come clean and cleanse my spirit in the name of Jesus Christ. So I have to come clean and tell the world the lies that went on through my mouth. I mean, now prosecutors and cops.
And that you killed seven men.
Huh?
That you killed those men in cold blood.
Yeah, and I got to come clean that I killed those seven men in first degree murder and robbery. As they said, they had it right. A serial killer. Not so much like thrill kill. I was into the robbing biz. I mean, you know, serial killers are in this thrill killing jazz. I was into the robbing, just and eliminate a witness. But still, then again, I got a number, so it's serial killer. But I'm coming clean before I go in that execution chamber and be executed that I killed them.
And so like when you met them from the beginning, did you know that you were going to kill them when they picked you up in their cars?
I pretty much had them selected that they were going to die.
So she got Independence Day wrong. She didn't know the 4th of July.
Well, you think, she says this June the 6th. I don't know what June the 6th
But she says
means.
Independence Day like the movie, and Independence Day the movie, you know, all the action takes place on July the 4th. Or
July
at least
the 4th.
Kicks off then. I don't, she must have had a very limited upbringing, and there's no indication that she even finished high school, is there?
No. Sue Russell in the Washington Post wrote on the movie, "I know that Hollywood routinely whitewashes or changes the truth, but doing that obscures the moral message of Eileen Wuornos's real life. Fictionalized or not, it's about a real person, and I can't help feeling that it's trying to fit Eileen's story into a more politically correct mold than the reality allows. It all but guarantees that she and her murders will end up on the microfiche of collective memory in a way that is fundamentally inaccurate, but closer to what her own hopes for her legacy were. None of the families of Eileen's victims were consulted over the movie, neither was State Prosecutor John Tanner. He would later say that he spent a lot of time and resources gathering evidence. This is the State Prosecutor John Tanner. He'd later say the movie gives the impression that at least some of the men deserved their fate at Eileen's hands, but he says that's a complete lie. When she accepted a Golden Globe for the role, Charlize Theron thanked to mention a lot of people, but didn't mention the victims. And again, we're back to this thing of, you know, whatever people think about men who use prostitutes or about prostitutes themselves, it's back to Harry Bosch's either everyone counts or no one does. And there was one review I read where the reporter, she challenged one of the producers about accuracy, and he says something along the lines of, well, we're not looking for specific truth, but we're trying to tell a greater truth. And she's like, what? A greater truth than the actual truth? You know, do me a favor. And she's quite sarcastic about it. And it's, yeah, you've dramatized it. And it says at the beginning, it's based on a true story, which is the kind of their get out of jail card.
So just on that point, I mean, did you find it entertaining?
Yes, it's gripping and it's compelling. But entertaining, it's like saying Schindler's List was entertaining. You know, it's a pretty grim subject matter.
It took me a little while to warm to it. I think Charlize Theron was playing this angry, aggressive, in-your-face person, and that was the one expression that she had for much of the start of the film. But, you know, something happened. She played it more subtly, and suddenly I was hooked in to, you know, a bit later into the movie. I think I liked it, yeah. I don't know. What score would you give it then, if it's gripping and all those other things? I don't know that I'd give it a 7.
Oh no, it's at least a 7 for me.
Yeah.
I don't think it pushes to an 8, but it's above 7, whereas First Man was probably slightly below 6.
Yeah.
Which I think is what we end up giving it for entertainment. So.
It did. The time flew quicker than it did with First Man, which did drag, as we've already said. So yeah, maybe.
It was a refreshingly short. I think it was an hour 40.
Yeah,
it was
okay.
A refreshingly shorter movie.
Mark it up
sure.
Just for that.
Yeah, yeah. I think 7.
Right. 7, agreed.
It's a good solid 7. Historical accuracy is difficult to judge because we don't know so many of the specifics. But I felt the tone was not very true to what we think we know about Eileen and her motivation for committing these crimes. But then, you know, in 1993, we thought one thing. In 95, she said something else. In 97, something else. In 2000, something else. So it's so difficult to tell. Really don't know. I don't think we can grade it more than a 6, probably, on accuracy.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I'd agree with that.
They used the actual bar.
Yeah, much to the barman's delight. So, they also compressed it, didn't they? They suggest that this all took place in a matter of weeks.
Yeah, it was over, it was about 14, 15 months.
In reality.
Was the period over which. Yeah, and they really didn't have a lead at first. They didn't. Now, how hard they were looking to find the killer of men who use prostitutes, hard to say. There may have been a thing amongst the cops who probably would get to know some of the prostitutes quite well. Well, if these guys want to go, you know, the girls are often prey to violent men. Maybe the men are getting some comeuppance. I don't know. I don't want to cast aspersions on the Florida Police Department's investigative drive or motivations, but I don't know. But until they got the fingerprint and the palm print on the car, the abandoned car, they don't really know. But if that was her 7th victim, Peter Seams, whose car it was, that would suggest that from there things moved pretty quickly.
Yeah,
they didn't
maybe
kill anyone else before they got her. So,
in summary, yeah, then, we both agree it's 6 on history, and I think 7 on entertainment. Maybe you 7.5,
yeah.
I don't know. 7.
Yeah, no, 6 and 7, I think, is reasonable enough. And interesting, I mean, audiences clearly rate it as a solid 8. So audiences and critics, so we're being a bit harsher. I think maybe because we look at the reality behind it, maybe we're a little bit more shying away from marking something up when it's on fairly gruesome material.
Yeah.
Having said that, I think I'm pretty sure we gave Schindler's List at least 9.
Yeah. Anyway,
yeah.
Hard to juggle. So if we're about to wrap it up, that's next time out, we're looking at finally The Untouchables.
We are indeed, yeah. Kevin Costner and
Sean Connery.
Going to do some good. Sean Connery and many, many, many other wonderful. Oh, yeah. Robert De Niro playing Al Capone. And that is quite. This is just going to be a two-parter.
Yeah, I imagine so.
Which, by the time you hear me say that, you'll already know. So then we'll be back with The Untouchables and we'll see how long that one runs for. It might be a little bit longer.
Quite possibly. All right, Marty, until next time.